We do have a quorum. We'd like to call the Higher Education Policy and Finance Committee to order. And to begin with, I'd like someone to offer a motion for the minutes of the 26th or 25th of January.
Mr. Chairman, I move the minutes be accepted.
Representative Benson moves the minutes from January 25th. Any corrections or comments? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. Our agenda calls for us to meet the new director of the Higher Education Office, but I think because there are still a few members to come, I'd like to wait so that we can do that when everyone is here. Is that okay? And begin with our presentation maybe from the Office of Higher Education. And
Mr. Chairman and members, I'm Tricia Grimes from the Office of Higher Education. And if it's all right with you, we plan to talk about the textbook report first, and then the Achieved Scholarship report, and then the one on intervention for college attendance.
Okay, very good.
And please let me know when you would like to stop and do the introduction.
Maybe we could do it between segments.
Okay, that'd be great. Okay, so the three reports we're going to be talking about today are legislatively mandated reports. One is on college textbooks and how to reduce the cost to students. One is on the Achieved Scholarship Evaluation. And one is the Intervention for College Attendance Program. And you'll be hearing more about those as we go along. The first one is the textbook cost study. I'd like to make sure to give credit to Amanda Capel, the graduate student intern who did the work and wrote the report under my supervision. Amanda finished her degree at the University of Minnesota's Humphrey Institute in December and is in her second week of a new full-time professional job, so she's not able to be here with us today. The mandate was to do a report on whether students are getting information about textbook costs that's now required under federal law, how that is being implemented, and recommendations, if any, for further legislation. And our approach was that we surveyed textbook publishers. We worked with five major textbook companies representing 90% of the textbook market. And we worked with the student associations in this project. Some of you may remember that in the last few years there have been some other efforts by student groups to have the state enact legislation on textbook and reducing textbook costs. And the Minnesota State University Student Association and the Minnesota State Community College Student Association have been very active in those efforts. This past year, it was the Student Association at the University of Minnesota Duluth that was particularly active in seeking this legislation. We also surveyed college bookstore operators across the state, and 62% of them did respond. So, kind of a summary of the report and recommendations. I'd just like to start out by saying that the online book market and textbook publishing in general are changing rapidly, as much of the publishing industry is. And if we were to have this conversation 4 years from now, I suspect it would be very different.
Yes.
The whole move to online books, rental books, e-books, and all of that is changing that field, that whole area of textbook publishing quite rapidly. We are not recommending state law changes as a part of this report. The market for textbooks is a national market, and the ability of Minnesota law to make much of an impact on that national textbook market is somewhat limited. We do know that reducing costs occur when publishers provide more options, prices, and information up front, and the federal law now requires them to do that, when campus bookstores provide clear information to students and faculty in a timely manner, and they now have some mandates about that also, and when faculty fully understand their options and the various impact that their textbook options will have on the cost to students. And when students understand their capacity to shop around for the best price, particularly if they can do that in advance. Faculty are the ones who select textbooks. When faculty understand the options that can save students money and submit their textbook selections early, students benefit from that because that gives them more time to locate books. Students who take the time to comparison shop can save money. There are websites that compare the price of a given book in several of the big online sellers just at one website. And we did a small experiment. Amanda priced the books for her fall semester term on various different websites and found that the price for books for one semester ranged from $140 if she picked the cheapest option in each case to $400. And now, in order to get $140, she would have had to order each book from a different site, or at least several of the books from different sites. But one of the things we try to remind students is that when comparing prices, they need to consider shipping time and expenses for their books. Because if they save $15 on a textbook, but the shipping costs eat up 10 of that, and then it's going to take 2 weeks to arrive, and they won't necessarily have it in time for class, that may not be in their best interest. And college bookstores are better able to offer the right quantity of used or rental books when they get the textbook information from faculty early. This is just a little bit of information from the survey of bookstores, of campus bookstores. The list of textbooks may not always be available as early as would be helpful to students because through no fault of the faculty, it may be that course sections are added late to meet student demand, and the faculty member may get limited warning of that they will be teaching an additional course. But this just gives an idea of what the bookstores say about whether they have the book identification number. The ISBN number is the barcode on the book. And when they have the ISBN number and retail price is the blue part of the bars, and when they have to list the textbook information is to be determined is the brown part of the bars. And you can see that 57% of the bookstores say they're getting, they get the ISBN numbers when class registration begins. Then that increases to 81% when it's 30 days prior to the start of classes, and 92% on the first day of class. So even in the best of all possible worlds, there will be occasions when a book may not be able to be listed very far ahead of time. But one of the things we have been stressing when we work with the students is that that they work with the faculty associations too to try to make sure that faculty know that it can make a big difference how much students pay for their textbooks if the faculty are able to get those textbook requests in early. We surveyed students at the fall conferences of the Minnesota State University Student Association and the Minnesota State Colleges Student Association. And these are some of the results from that. I have to tell you, the survey was not a large sample, nor was it a random sample. It also did not include students attending private colleges or the University of Minnesota. We were just trying to get a little real-world test of what a group of students were experiencing when it came to trying to find the information on their textbooks. These students that we surveyed are involved in student government on their campuses and are more fully engaged in life on campus than the average student. We asked the students, if in stock, how often do you prefer to buy new books from your school bookstore, used books from your school bookstore, or books online? And if you look at the group of bars labeled often, you can see that State University students said they often buy used books from university bookstore or buy books online. Community college students also said they often buy used books from the college bookstore, but they were less likely to say that they often buy books online. I've gone through this kind of fast, but in conclusion, getting textbook orders into the school's bookstore as early as possible is the single best way for colleges and faculty to help students reduce their textbook costs because it gives the students the time to comparison shop. The students also need time to investigate their options and be smart shoppers. We continue to work with the student associations on this issue and urge them to consider having like smart shopping tips on their Facebook pages and things like that to try to help get the word out to students how to reduce their costs.
Well, thank you for that report. I do have a couple questions for you, Representative Mannion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm interested in this because we do a lot of this over at St. Cloud State, and I got a specific question about an idea that's happened on our campus at least, and I think perhaps at other campuses, which is the renting of textbooks. I don't think I heard anything about that here, and I'm wondering if you've talked about the possibility of renting a textbook. Most people don't want their textbook at the end of their term. I wish they would keep their economics textbooks, but they don't. So could you tell me something about that, please?
Ms. Bryan?
Mr. Chairman, Minnesota State Colleges and Universities have a pilot project going on about using rental textbooks more. And the publishers provided us with some information after we had already prepared this report to show that there's been a substantial increase on the part of publishers in offering rental books. The rental books, sometimes even the students are allowed to highlight them and all that. Depending on how much they highlight them or mark in them, it may affect, there may be a fine or something when they return the rental book. But the publishers are and the bookstores are trying to offer many more rental options. There also are options developing where a campus or a group of campuses may buy a license for an online version of the book. And I was surprised to learn that custom textbooks, you know, where a faculty member may want to just use chapters 3 through 11 out of a 15-chapter textbook, custom textbooks actually sometimes are less expensive than the standard textbook.
Follow-up?
Just to follow up along that same line, campuses have historically had student book exchanges to allow students to basically trade books with each other, which also could have helped to reduce costs. Did you do anything on that in this report?
Ms. Grimes?
Mr. Chairman, we really kind of included that in the idea of book buybacks, and that's one of the things, the book buybacks and the extent to which the campus bookstore will buy back books. They are much better able to get the right books and the right number of books for a course, again, the earlier that they get the textbook selections from faculty. And then they do try to facilitate exchanges and buyback programs.
Representative Benson?
I'm particularly sensitive to this. I guess I put 4 kids through college, and I paid for all their books, and it just seems like, you know, H1 got a little bit more expensive. I also teach, and I know that I have to shop very carefully because many of those textbooks that I would use in the business program are a couple hundred bucks a piece. And some concerns, you know, as we speak to where the whole market is going, and I've used just, you know, it'd be probably McGraw-Hill and Cengage and all these publishers, and they do have some great new tools to select out. But, you know, you can't trade or sell a book like that. And they're really not all that difference in price. I mean, there's some, but there's no way for the student to sell it to someone else or sell it back to the bookstore typically, at least in my experience. And the same thing would go with the electronic book. You know, so I'm a real free enterpriser, but I'm also sensitive to the cost of higher education. So, you know, there's probably not going to be money for you to continue with additional research on this, but I would advocate for some continued watching of this whole element. And if I'm not mistaken, there's some recent federal laws regarding how soon schools have to publish what the student has to take, which would help immensely in this whole not having to wait. Not that I don't have students that wait to the last minute to do that, and for 2 weeks then I'm copying chapters for them to keep them up to date, but this is a huge driver in increase in higher education costs. So maybe it's more of a comment than a question. Sorry.
Thank you, Representative Benson. Representative Dittmer?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mrs. Grimes, do you see the publishers maybe going more towards the electronic book? I know my wife just bought one of these, I don't know if they're called Kindles or whatever, and do you see publishers maybe going that route with electronic books?
Mrs. Grimes?
Mr. Chairman, my understanding is that publishers will likely be offering several options as we go forward, but many of them will include an e-book option where it could be purchased and read on an e-book reader. There are some national random sample surveys that indicate that it's still right now true that a large number of students prefer a print textbook. But as the e-book readers and the Kindles and so forth get more common, I'm guessing that will change.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Grimes, the and I'll say it more bluntly, I think the cost of textbooks is an absolute outrageous, egregious ripoff, and it's getting worse. My question, I'm looking through the study, and I don't see anything that actually talks about prices. The word price is used, but did we track over the last 5 or 10 years the actual prices of individual editions of books? Because it'd be, I suspect it's soaring.
Ms. Grimes?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, we did not. That was not part of our mandate. We did do this little experiment where we had the graduate student price her books and in shopping for them various different ways. And her own books for that semester, if she'd have gotten the cheapest one at each website, not counting the shipping costs, it would have been $140, and the most expensive option would have been $400. So there was a $260 swing just within existing prices. But in order to get the cheap prices, she would have had to order the books from several different websites. And that's where it's important for the student who's comparison shopping to compare how much the shipping costs are and what delay there will be in getting the book to see if that's still going to work as a feasible option for them. My understanding is that, yes, textbook prices have been increasing, but it's getting harder to generalize about textbook prices because of all of these rental and e-book and custom textbook options. It's harder to just price the standard textbook and assume that everyone is using because it varies a lot by campus.
And just want to describe a, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Grimes, I'll describe a scenario and then please tell me if it's still occurring. I taught, I don't know, maybe 15 or 20 courses over the course of my life, nothing in the last 5 or 6 or 7 years, but I refused to use a textbook, preferring to create my own materials because I thought that the cost of textbooks was an absolute outrageous, egregious ripoff. And then I would get contacted by the book companies, the publishing companies, sending me books to review. And they'd send me $100 to review those books. And I'd take a look at the books, and I'd send back their $100. And then they continued to send me money, which I sent back. And then finally, I got an offer from one saying, how about you write your own book? And they made a proposal in which I would get a lot of money by writing my own book that they would then charge an outrageous, egregious, ripoff kind of price for. My question to you is, and I don't see that in the study, maybe that wasn't the mandate, but is that still going on?
Mr. Chairman, my understanding is that the federal legislation attempted to at least require more disclosure of that kind of thing so that the students would be clear on whether they were being asked to buy the textbook written by the faculty member from which they were taking the course. There's been, I believe, some effort to constrain that. I'm not sure how effective it has been in practice. In terms of one of the things that happens with the way they can do custom textbooks now is I think it's much easier now than it would have been a few years ago for a faculty member to have a custom textbook that is essentially a few chapters each from several existing textbooks, for example, that might be their textbook for their class. And so I'm guessing that there's a little bit less incentive for a faculty member to write it on his own, but perhaps some of the other faculty members on the committee would know that better than I.
Representative Bandy, do you have a comment? I was going to ask, just in addition to that, is there a lot of competition within publishers, or is it kind of a monopoly in itself?
I think, Mr. Chairman, I think there is a fair amount of competition. I've had the same offer that Representative Atkins has had. I, too, have turned it down. I do not know what the rule is within Minsku. My own practice, because I do have an unpublished text, is I simply give it away for the course that I teach. I just say, here, you know, I just need you to give me some paper, and I even pay for the ink so they can read it. Now I don't have to do that. I put it online. And I know when I was in graduate school, I had to use textbooks by two of my professors, and in both cases, they bought the book and gave it to us at the cost that they had to pay so that they were not receiving any benefit from that. Do we have, in Minsku, do we have regulations like that and governing the use of, I mean, or in the U of M? I suspect it's just a university by university basis. I don't know that it's just on the honor of the.
I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay.
I think we'll get an answer.
Did I answer your question, Chair?
Yeah.
Okay.
You did. Any other? Oh, Representative Benson, sorry.
Just one more comment. If you do some ongoing studies, I think one of the biggest drivers of the expense of books to students is how frequently they change editions. And that's what I see, especially in the business department, because there's always some kind of new phenomenon in the business world, and they put out new chapters in print. And very quickly, it's out of print. Students can't get the old textbook. So when you're doing this again, if you continue this at all, please add that element, because it is a significant factor in the cost of books.
Mr. Chairman,
actually
the federal law that was adopted 2 years ago, they did require publishers to provide specific information about the content revisions between editions, so that to help the faculty member figure out whether it's worthwhile to order the new edition or whether they can advise their students, well, if you get the old edition, you're going to be missing a key chapter or that kind of thing. But the publishers are now required to provide much more information about what has happened between revisions of editions of a given textbook.
Okay. Thank you for that part of our update today. We'd like to maybe pause here for just a few minutes to introduce Dr. Sheila Wright, if she'd like to step to the table, so we can all be introduced to the new Director of Office of Higher Education, and welcome to the Higher Education Committee.
Good morning. Thank you, Chairman Nornes and representatives. My name is Sheila Wright. I am Director of the Office of Higher Education, and it's a delight to be here today and to meet you. The Governor and I are looking forward to working with you on these issues, critical issues before us in post-secondary education. Indeed, we all want the same thing. We want a better Minnesota that where our citizens can aspire towards their dreams and can accomplish those things that bring a better quality of life for all of us. And indeed, it's a challenge. It's a real challenge today for the students, for the families, for all of you, us, for all of you as policymakers. We know that. Looking at the data, we know that in the coming months ahead, by the year 2018, that about 70% of the jobs that will be available for our citizens will require that they be retrained. And we know that there are many citizens out of work now who are looking towards coming back to higher ed. And so they need to also have that kind of accessible access to quality higher education. I think that working together, we will be able to accomplish some of those difficult problems ahead. We don't know, but we're looking forward to that. And the staff and I are here to help and willing to assist in any way we can in answering your questions for you. So it's a joy to be here.
Dr. Wright, can you just give us a real brief synopsis of your background, where you came from? And
I'm coming out of higher ed, actually, just a couple of days ago. I just started yesterday. Just a couple of days ago, I was dean of the School of Education and at Hamline University. And as all of you know, as the dean of School of Education, that understanding of pipeline from P-12 right into higher ed is something that's very pressing and familiar with my experience. I come out as a prior teacher, as someone who has worked as an advocate for children and families, and trying to raise quality of education for all.
Well, thank you for being here today, and we look forward to seeing you often.
Thank you. Thank you.
Anyone have a question? Otherwise, we'll move back to our presentation from... Okay. Mark?
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, I'm Mark Mishkans, the Director of Finance and Research with the Office of Education. And I'm going to present you a summary of the ACHIEVE report. I think you all have copies. I will refer to it a few pages in here. And the manager of the program, Megan Fitzgibbons, is here in case we get into a lot of the details. She works with the program on a daily basis. I have about five slides here I'll work through. Essentially, the summary of the program, there's a year-to-year summary on each of the slides, and then the second slide actually is about eligibility. The program was established in 2007. This was an initiative of Governor Plenty that year. In fact, he had started talking about that, I think, the prior summer. It was a bit of a difficult program to get enacted. If Representative Rucavina remembers, I think the bill was vetoed because initially it did not contain the program. Coming out of that session, it had an appropriation of about $10 million for the following biennium. $3 million of that was set aside for use for what we use for counselors in the schools towards the program. We ended up spending about $2.1 million out of the remaining appropriation and canceled back about $5 million of the $10 million. The whole premise of the program is to create incentives for students to take more rigorous course taking while they're in high school so they're better prepared for college. We have seen some data from ACT. Of the 70% of the students leaving high school that actually take the ACT, roughly a third are considered ready for college according to ACT standards. So it's a problem, I think, for all policymakers to deal with. But the program was established in 07. It was changed the following, in the 09 session. Actually, the Senate, at that time, Senator Pappas, as chair, had taken an interest in it and made some amendments to it as well. And let me just kind of work through some of the results here. I'm sorry, let me back up, Mr. Chair. Members, talk about eligibility a bit. I did refer to the rigorous course taking. That was part of the initial design of the program. Students are required in order to be eligible to graduate under one of four different scenarios. And in the report, you can see on page six, these are listed programs either in an AP advanced placement or an international baccalaureate, a dual program, a dual credit program, which includes PSEO requirements, or something called State Scholars Initiative. These are all worked together with the Department of Education as well in the state. Students have to meet certain financial need requirements. Initially, the program had a $75,000 adjusted gross income limitation. That was changed in a later session to the requirement was changed, to only students only had to be either eligible for a Pell or a state grant, and they would be eligible for the CHEAP program as well. And then an important requirement on the part of students is that they had to enroll the following fall. The idea was to keep continuity in an educational program for a student, which would help on their success. So once a student graduated in the spring of a particular year in order to receive the CHEAP scholarship, the following year they had to enroll in a post-secondary institution. So let me just talk about some program outcomes over the course of the essentially 3 years this thing has been operating, 09, 10, and we're in the third year in fiscal 11. In the first year, about 19,000 students, high school students, were recipients. Actually, you can find some of these numbers on the last page of the document of the report. About 19,000 in the first year. Important, they represented high schools from across the state. This was one of the concerns when this was first discussed 3 years ago, is if you're going to require rigorous course taking on the part of students, our small high schools can't offer that to schools, to students in our high schools, because we just don't have the capacity to do that. As we found out, students from across the state were able to meet the requirements, which I think is evidence that it was working and that those concerns were addressed in the structure of the program. The average income is about $45,000, so these are not students that come from rich families. They tend to attend schools from across the sectors, both the for-profit, not-for-profit, and the two public sectors. And again, there are various tables in the report that show that breakdown by sectors, both for 08 and 09. I'm sorry, for 08 graduates from 2008 and graduates from 2009. And these students continue on in school. So that's a good sign, too. Retention matters for these students as well. We spent, as I mentioned, $2.1 million was spent on the appropriation that first year. But we were really concerned about the significant cancellation back to the general fund. So came back with a number of changes the following year, one of which was to make the application for the program a bit easier. This led to some demand of the program we didn't anticipate initially. Spending spiked dramatically. The available resources on fiscal year 2010 was about $4.3 million. We had spending demand of about $8.8 million. So as members of this committee that were on here last year, remember we had to go through quite a few adjustments moving money between programs, between fiscal years, to meet the demand for that particular year, the 8.8. And frankly, a lot of the demand for the program ended up at the University of Minnesota, which concerned members of the committee. Again, let me refer to the last page of this chart. You can see that of the 808 graduates, about 1,900 was the total. For the 09 graduates, fiscal 10, it grew to 3,400. But if you just look up about five lines, you see the University of Minnesota Twin City campus. There was it's a considerable spike there. Went from 288 to almost 1,200. While that is significant, that represents 60% of the change between the 2 years. So there was a significant increase amongst other schools as well. The remaining 40% came from other schools where we did not make the administrative change that we did. But again, almost all the counties in the state were represented in the program, all but one. Adjusted gross income for those families was roughly in the same range at about 43,000. The number of institutions attended were a bit lower, went dropped from 77 to 69. But again, the retention rate was significant. So where are we today with this? Because of the issues last year, a number of changes were made in order to restrict funding for the program. We are only spending about $1.2 million. That was the conversation last year with the legislature. And the number of restrictions were imposed. There is a cap on the available scholarship. It's only $1,200 now. But we think that the number of recipients is going to drop from the 3,400 from last year down to about 800. So that's declined significantly. And the application process is reverted back to what it was 2 years ago. Initially from the program, we're not working with the university in the same way that we were. And we're on target for the $1.2 million spending that we had discussed. So we're that is well within the program demand at this point. Moving forward, Mr. Chair and members, there is money in the base for this program. I believe it's $2.35 million for each year. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll stand for questions.
Thank you. Members have a question or two? Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one question, and that is there any effort to match these folks up with some STEM? Can they just about take any program that they'd like? Or is there any effort to promote STEM as part of this program?
Mr. Chair and members, there's not a particular effort. I think that was certainly part of the conversation when it was initiated, is the whole shortfall in the STEM disciplines. But it's not targeted in any kind of way either.
Anyone else? Lois, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we'd like to hear now from Nancy Waters. Ms. Waters, welcome to the committee.
Chairman Nornes, committee members. As Chairman Nornes indicated, I'm Nancy Walters. I work for the Office of Higher Education, and I'm here to report on the ICAP program. The statute for the Intervention for College Attendance Program specifies that the program is to award grants to foster post-secondary attendance and retention by providing outreach services to historically underserved students in grades 6 through 12 and to historically underrepresented college students. Funded projects target low-income students, students who would be first-generation college students, and students traditionally underrepresented in higher education. The ICAP program is guided by the need to strengthen high school graduation rates and college preparation rates for Minnesota students. Background to the need for the program is shown in this slide. This slide shows the four-year graduation rate for 2009. In 2009, 75% of all of Minnesota's seniors graduated. 82% of Minnesota seniors who were white students graduated, and 50% of the students of color graduated. Also note that 50% of the students of color graduated. Also note that 54% of the students who participated in free and reduced price lunch graduated from high school in 4 years. Additional information to document the background for the ICAP program comes from the ACT. ACT developed indicators of college readiness. In their indicators of college readiness, they developed benchmarks for each of the four testing areas of college entrance exams. Less than one-third of Minnesota's ACT test takers were prepared academically to succeed in all four subject areas. And these four subject areas are college-level English, social studies, algebra, and biology. Minnesota students of color were less college-ready overall than white students. In 2010, Minnesota had about 44,000 students to take the ACT, and this is about 70% of the high school seniors for 2010. So the ICAP program has been in existence since the year 2000. The report before you summarizes program activities for fiscal year 2009 and fiscal year 2010. This slide shows the location of projects funded by the Intervention for College and the Intervention for College Attendance Program. We had 21 projects funded in 2009, and those 21 projects are listed on pages 7 and 8 of the report. We had 20 projects, and these are all matching grant projects. 20 projects were funded in fiscal year 2010, and those projects are listed on page 8 and 9 of the report. And we did have multiple projects at some of the sites on the map. We had multiple projects in our metropolitan areas, Duluth, St. Cloud, the Twin Cities, and also multiple projects in Northfield. I'll talk a little about program activities. Now, ACT projects that 80% of the fastest growing occupations between 2008 and 2018 will require some post-secondary education. Thus, our ICAP grants focused on strengthening high school graduation by increasing the rigorous course taking by students and increasing graduation numbers. We also focused on increasing post-secondary attendance and success. College enrollment and success is dependent on many factors. All projects have a focused and sustained emphasis on preparing students for and or helping students succeed academically in their rigorous coursework. Projects also provide social supports that are developmentally appropriate, interrelated, and proven to be effective in helping students achieve. Our projects provide information about college admission and college financing. Projects help students learn about the college environment so that they don't become freshmen on campus having to learn about college as they start college. Now I want to talk about some of the highlights of the programs. And these are just a few highlights and not a complete summary of project accomplishments. The first project that I'll talk about is a project out of Northfield. And this is the Torch Project described on page 20 of the report. And I'll give you a second to turn to page 20. I'm sorry, page 26. Page 26 of the report. This is the Torch Project. Tackling Obstacles and Raising College Hopes. Now, this is a project out of Northfield, and we have the project director, Marnie Thompson, here in the audience. Now, one of the major focuses for the Torch Project was to improve high school graduation. Another focus was to assure college success. This is a comprehensive program for middle school students, middle and high school students, and it also provides follow-up as the students transition to post-secondary institutions. The program description is on the left of the page. And if you'll note, it indicates that for this past year, the program included 93 middle school students, 104 high school students, and 50 post-secondary students. These students had academic counseling, one-on-one mentoring, a range of activities that help students advance to the point where they were able to take part in post-secondary enrollment options. So if you look to the right on page 26, I've noted just some of the evidence of effectiveness of the Torch program. And for the Torch program, they had 91% of their seniors graduate from high school, and the remaining 9% were scheduled to finish high school during this past summer. So you'll note their evidence of effectiveness. And the Torch program's positive outcomes with students is noteworthy, because before the Torch program started in 2005, fewer than 5 Northfield Latino students attended post-secondary institutions during the time period of 2001 to 2004. For this past academic year alone, out of the Torch program, they had 16 seniors who were Latino students, low-income students, and students of color applied for post-secondary institutions. So that's just an example of the advancements the Torch program has had in working with Latino and low-income students out of Northfield. The second program that I want to highlight is Breakthrough St. Paul. And Emily Wingfield, the program director for Breakthrough St. Paul, is also in the audience. So if you have specific questions of any of these project directors, they're here and they're very willing to talk about their programs. But Breakthrough St. Paul, on page 22 of your report, there's a brief description of that project. Breakthrough St. Paul focuses on strengthening academic background and enrollment in honors courses of St. Paul public school students. This project supports low-income students from St. Paul, and during this past academic year, they worked with 147 middle and high school students. And these students attended enrichment programs and had other activities to help them be better prepared for their high school courses and moving on to college. An added feature of the Breakthrough program is their use of college students reflective of the school system's participants to teach in the program. So the students have a chance to be mentored by staff reflective of their racial ethnic identity. And if you'll note under evidence of effectiveness for project a breakthrough, for their evidence of effectiveness, it's highlighted by the fact that 73% of their students during the 2009-10 school year were enrolled in at least one honors course. They had 100% of the high school students enrolled in an honors course. And these students had averages in these courses of B and above. And that's very noteworthy for our students. Now, another point about Breakthrough. Breakthrough's oldest cohort of students, they're now 12th graders. They've all applied to between 8 and 10 schools, and they're beginning to hear about their financial aid award and their acceptance. And I'm sure they're hearing about some fantastic financial aid awards, because Breakthrough has had a very good track record in connecting students with financial aid. In fact, a number of Breakthrough St. Paul students have received the Jack Kent Cook Foundation Scholarship. And this is a scholarship that will begin to support students even as early as 7th grade and it could support students from 7th grade through graduate school. So just very noteworthy activities about a program that we support. Another project that I want to highlight, and it's described on page 23, and this is a project out of St. Cloud Technical College. So it's described on page 23, and the project at St. Paul Technical College works with middle school and junior high students, and the intent is to improve their academic attainment, to familiarize them with post-secondary education, and to inform parents about financial aid and careers for their students. So a very intense program serving students out of St. Cloud, and this is one of our programs, one of a number of ICAP programs, working to introduce students to STEM careers. And the director of the program at St. Cloud Technical College, Greg Riekstedt, is also in the audience. Another program that I want to highlight, and I'm not going to talk about all 20 of them. Another program, we have an ICAP grant with Minneapolis Achieve. And for this program, the ICAP grant supplements the Achieve program's career and college initiatives in Minneapolis. And we supplement the work that they do by providing ACT test preparation for students. A description of this project is found on page 13 of your report. So we've supplemented their efforts to help students to be better prepared for colleges and for their eventual career by helping students prepare for the ACT test so that they could improve their scores. This is one of a number of projects that we have that provide ACT test preparation for students. And this is important, we feel this is important to support because many students aren't aware of the opportunities that test preparation provide for them. And on page 13, you can note the evidence of the effectiveness of Achieve's work in helping students be better prepared for the ACT test. It notes that just on the practice exam, the students increased their score between 3 and 4.8 points from their baseline to the final practice exam. And the project that they completed last year, gains were made by all students. So another very important factor. And for Minneapolis Achieve, Arnice Roberson, who's the manager of the Achieve College and Career Centers, is also here in the audience. The last project that I want to highlight is found on page 18. And this is a grant to the Learning Disabilities Association. This project, this project provided writing classes for immigrant female students in St. Paul. And if you look at the description of the effectiveness of the program, our evidence of effectiveness, you'll note that for the 2009-10 school year, 100% of the program seniors graduated from high school, compared to 71% of the English language learner students at participating charter schools, and 48% of the English language learner students from St. Paul Public Schools. So again, a program to help students be better prepared for college and careers. And Arthur Dorman, the program director, we're from Learning Disabilities Association, is also here in the audience. So I could go on and talk about the other projects, but they are all of the projects are summarized for you in the report before you. I want to talk a little bit now about program outcomes. For us, in assessing the effectiveness of funded programs, programs were all reviewed to determine how they reflect effective college readiness and retention characteristics. College readiness and retention characteristics identified in the literature. Page 93 of the report before you displays these indicators. page 93 begins a display of these indicators. And these indicators of college readiness and retention are students being successful in core curriculum, test preparation and assessment, career exploration, academic preparation and support, college exploration and participation, mentoring and guidance, obtaining financial assistance, development of social and emotional non-cognitive skills. And in the report from page 93 to page 99, these pages note how different projects conducted activities reflected of these indicators. Now, the ICAP projects that we funded serve a diversity of student needs throughout the state of Minnesota. Student needs, and we serve these needs with different program activities. The report before you indicates that we serve students from grade 6 through post-secondary, students in small towns and rural areas, students in urban settings, English language learners, students in alternative school programs, students needing to improve state assessments, to improve post-secondary placement scores, college admission test scores. We serve low-income students needing to have access to college prep resources, students needing to develop a pattern of rigorous course taking, and students who will be the first generation college student. So the ICAP projects serve Minnesota students, and they reflect college retention and college readiness. In summary, we currently have 20 projects that we're funding for this fiscal year. For this past year, 2,579 students from grades 6 through 12 participated in ICAP activities. 378 post-secondary students participated and ICAP activities. The programs were supported by $674,000 of state funds. These programs matched the state funds with additional financial and in-kind support totaling over $1 million, $1.3 million. So I've given you a brief summary of the ICAP program and a brief summary of the information contained in the report. Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, and we recognize the hard work that went into all of these reports. Appreciate that. I have a question from Representative Benson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. When I see the word project, I think of at least a short duration, a beginning of an end, and I, looking at your material, ICAP's been going since about 2000.
Mm-hmm.
So my assumptions, at least, are this is a process. You're starting in grade 6 and going through sixth grade through 12th grade. My interest is in you've had to develop some best practices, and when do these become not projects so much as processes within the regular school district, and is that appropriate? And how do we take it from ICAP to this is the way we do business? I think we're all kind of concerned about looking at the statistics that in your second slide regarding 50% of students of color not graduating from high school.
Mm-hmm.
And if this is identified methods or processes by which we can improve that dramatically,
mm-hmm.
When does it become not a project? And I'm a newbie on the higher education mm-hmm. committee, so I'm looking for information.
Mm-hmm.
But when do we take it from a project to this is what we're doing because it makes sense and we've developed best practices, and when do we duplicate them and that kind of thing?
Ms. Walters?
Mr. Chairman, I think it's all a part of educating the public, education decision makers about best practices that will support students. We do have some instances when schools are partnering with these projects, but your question about when do you take it on, I think when people really feel that this is a necessary activity, and when school systems and other organizations, higher ed institutions, nonprofit organizations, when they have enough money to really incorporate it into their day-to-day activities.
follow-up. Representative Benson.
How is this shared? How is this information? It's shared with the committee now, but do you go to other workshops and share this with district staff about the success stories and the processes that you've gone through to get to the...
The information is shared, Mr. Chairman. The information is shared by efforts out of our office. I will make presentations at professional organizations. Our project directors share information about the work that they do. For example, I mentioned the Torch Project. A number of their staff members are in St. Paul today in a workshop with other people participating in furthering knowledge about college access. So they're sharing their information. The Torch Project, again, at a statewide program in November, they did a presentation. And this is true for all of the projects. People share information with others, other people of interest within the state. And even with Breakthrough St. Paul is part of a national network. And that information about what's being done in St. Paul is shared by others nationally. So we make efforts to get the information out, but helping people see that this is a needed activity that needs to be supported by others, I would say yes, that is a challenge.
Mr. Chair, one more follow-up. Mm-hmm. Then, is your organization then an incubator for ideas, or, I mean, does this sunset at some point because everybody's bought into all the things that have been demonstrated that makes sense and we've, you know, we meet the goals and...
Mr. Chair, I'm hoping it's not sunsetted because our focus, again, is working with students. And even though we move some students through, and we have students who move through and move into college, there are still students moving into sixth grade who need these services. So sunsetting it would mean that we might have, you know, 3,000 students who wouldn't be able to benefit from the services that the programs provide because they're just moving into the pipeline where we could provide support for them.
One more follow-up.
Okay,
okay, and I didn't ask my question right, I guess, then. Is that I'm not interested in stopping, you know, this 3,000 students from getting what they need mm-hmm. so much as we make this a part of the regular process of how we do education, does ICAP still need to exist? Or do you see it as, you know, maintaining as a organization and incubating new ideas? That's where I went with the question. Was that clear yet?
Maybe not clear.
Okay.
Because, Mr. Chair, I do feel it needs to continue to exist. I'm looking at the student end and seeing students who need to be served.
No, I'm looking at the projects. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. No, I'm just saying that all these projects, if we could incorporate them in the way we do business at the district level, mm-hmm. my interest, of course, then is what else does the current staff that you work for do? Does it continue to incubate new ideas, incorporate?
The staff, Mr. Chair, the staff with existing projects.
Ms. Grimes?
Mr. Chairman, if I could chime in here. One of the things that we're finding happening is the projects end up serving different kinds of students as time goes on. For example, currently we have a number of projects that serve students that are concentrated in areas with high Somali populations. In the past, I believe we've had some projects that served students that had higher recent Hmong immigrant populations. And so as my understanding is that the projects are very diverse in the approach they use in working with the students and in the types of students they use, and that we are likely to continue to see a pretty wide variety of students who are first in their families and low income, because the demographic projection is that that's going to be a higher percentage of those coming into and leaving high school is those who are low income and first generation and students of color. So I'm guessing that there will still be demand, at least, for programs that particularly work with a given pocket of students that we're trying to reach and make sure they understand the difference that college can make in their future.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Benson.
One last, and this will be a short answer, I'm sure. My question is then how do you propagate these in the state of Minnesota? I'm assuming, you know, I've got a Somali population in Rochester, and you don't have, on your map, there weren't any projects down there that I'm aware of, at least, and I see Representative Norton's not in the room now, but I'd like to, why, you know, how do we propagate the ideas, and I'd like for you to go away because everybody's glummed on to what you know you've proven to be successful ideas.
Okay, Mr.
Ms.
Chair,
Walters.
The program has been a competitive grant process, so I solicit proposals from people interested in providing these services. And 4 years ago was the last time I had, 3 years ago, the last time I had a proposal process, because the legislature 1 year ago indicated that this could be a continuation grant program for this biennium so that we could collect data so that existing projects could work with students for more than a two-year period so that they could provide sustained report, sustained support, and we could collect information about outcomes. But it is a competitive process. So I get information out to the campuses, to our community organizations, and they apply for the funding.
Thank you.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I apologize for being late. I was sort of in that learning period. My daughter had a college interview that the interviewer showed up a little bit late to. So I feel like I'm on the parent side, looking at this whole process through the student side. But I was listening to NPR as I was waiting for my daughter. And Kathy Tunheim, new working with the governor's office, was talking about jobs. And she was talking about the fact that Minnesota, the workforce in Minnesota in the coming years is going to decline in raw numbers unless we take some actions. And I'm looking right here. It's nice to have access to the iPad right here, Mr. Chair. I'm looking why enrollment of lower-income students matters. And this is a report specific about Minnesota. And I think you're touching on my it's either a question or a comment, but you probably can fill in the numbers better than I can. But as I'm looking at this report, Minnesota's facing a number of challenges here. If we look at traditionally the students in Minnesota who've gone to Minnesota colleges and universities, that pool declines in raw number. I teach at Gustavus. I know that we're trying to figure out what do we do. Do we get more of the Minnesota kids, getting them from St. Olaf and Carleton, and please don't let them know that we're competing? Do we bring in more students from out of state, or do we bring in more students who have not traditionally come to Gustavus? So as you're talking about the programs, am I right in understanding? I want to understand the issue that ICAP and other people, other programs and initiatives trying to solve. And I think the problem is because lower income, underrepresented, first generation high school students have not traditionally been going to high to college. We need it at the same rate. We need to increase that rate. We've talked about the achievement gap. Mm-hmm. Am I right in understanding that differential number, and that's the goal of ICAP and a number of other programs?
Mr. Chair, yes, that is the goal of ICAP, because our target population, low-income students, first-generation students, students who who normally don't have the benefit of the guidance that middle-class students will have. They won't have the benefit of the advanced course taking. They don't have the benefit of the college preparatory environment. So the intent through ICAP is to help better prepare our low-income first-generation students so that schools like Gustavus and others will have freshman classes of students able to move through and succeed and satisfy the career needs and the job needs in Minnesota.
And Mr. Chair, if I may follow up, we have to be careful with a map like the ICAP map, because I know at Rochester Century School, for example, I know they got programming to work with the Somali students, because I worked with a student at Gustavus who had worked in that program at Century. We could overlay an ICAP map with an ACHIEVE map with the efforts of private industry, with the efforts of the Rotary and the Lions, and the efforts of the Minnesota Private College Council. And we'd probably find that there's a lot going on throughout the state of Minnesota. I, too, look at maps representative events. I say, well, where's Mankato on that map? Well, probably because Mankato shows up on a different map of a different effort. So I applaud you, and I think, Mr. Chair, we have to be very careful as we have these presentations to remember the factual background we're dealing with in jobs, the economy, and the needs of Minnesota's colleges, universities, and workforce.
Thank you very much. Representative Poppy, you're next.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I commend you for this work, because it appears as though for very little money you are impacting very many students. And I just think that's marvelous. I'll tell you that I work at Riverland Community College, so I've had the opportunity to work with some of the Torch students. And I Maybe, I don't know if the torch person would like to come up, but I believe there also is a benefit to at least one of the colleges in Northfield that also works with the torch students. And so it isn't just those students that are coming through in the secondary school. It's also the post-secondary school. And I just, if I understand that correctly, I just wanted, maybe Marnie would have the opportunity to describe that a little bit.
Welcome, and please identify
yourself.
Thank you.
I'm Marnie Thompson from Northfield, Minnesota, and I am the project director for Torch. And it's actually a partnership between Carleton, Riverland, and Northfield Public Schools, where our high school students are able to take Riverland classes online without ever leaving Northfield. And so we have right now 20 students engaged in those classes. They meet weekly at Carleton with student assistants who help them with the college-level coursework. And we have a Torch employee that keeps the kids kind of organized and on task. And then the Riverland instructors, of course, are offering the online education. So we can offer a two-year, we're almost at having enough courses to offer a two-year degree without ever leaving Northfield, and for high school students. So they can graduate in June with not only their high school diploma, but a two-year AA degree. And it's at no cost to them. It's part of the PSEO program. And that has been just a really amazing partnership between those three entities. And then we've been able to expand it to include some students from Faribault that are also also coming over. And then we have, because of the partnership, we currently have 8 students that are full-time living in Albert Lea, going to Riverland full-time. These are students that would never have been able to access a college education because of the costs associated with it. So that's the partnership that that the representative is referring to.
Thank you, and thank you for that description, because I think that's important too, that the college students from Carleton are also learning some community service, maybe some educational skills themselves to be tutors and to be able to be involved in that, and for very little amount of money for you to be able to provide that, probably less of an amount than you would have received for a single teacher to be able to be involved in that. Is that
sure? I can tell you that the cost of that actually for us from the Torch budget is $10,000, because I'm contracting with a Carleton graduate who has decided to stay on, and he's contracted for, well, it's actually a partnership, so he's on a contract, but out of the Torch budget, it's $10,000.
Thank you. And just one final comment, I think, Mr. Chair, would just be that, again, as we're looking at the overall cost and benefit, and I would concur that it needs to continue on into the future, because for each single student that you are impacting, that's a tremendous value to all of us in the state. So for very few dollars, you are doing great work, and thank you.
Thank you. We have another question. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of going back to Representative Benson's questions and comments, I think one of the things, questions that I have is that I agree, this is a great program. It's been started, and what you're doing is great. The question that I have is, at what point do we turn this over to the independent school districts and say, hey, here's the model for you to use, and begin to have them just implement it across the state or at their own choice? But, you know, and then I think it is to Representative Benson's question, that at what point do we sunset this from a special ICAP grant to independent school districts having that opportunity to take it on and do it themselves?
Mr. Chair,
Ms. Walters?
The intent of the ICAP program is to help students understand post-secondary education and be prepared for post-secondary education. So a large part of what the projects do does involve work as a partnership, work with higher education. And we're dependent on the resources, the expertise from higher education to really help students be better prepared. Because earlier in my presentation, I indicated that part of what we do is help students get an understanding of what college is like before they get there. So in turning any program over, I think we would have to be cognizant of the need to make sure that the higher education is there as a strong partner so that students can benefit from activities like the courses they take at Riverland, like the time they spend on campus getting oriented. So in turning it over, the question of when, I don't have an answer to. My concern is the structure of programs as they continue, so that we make sure the partnership continues and make sure that the programs are reflective of our college readiness and retention indicators. We have many grantees. Marnie is with high school, so their high school is working as a grantee. We have grantees who are two-year institutions like St. Cloud Technical College. We have our four-year institutions like Carleton as grantees. So they all have a role to play. But your answer about when it's turned over, I couldn't answer that question.
Okay, any other comments, questions? Otherwise, again, thank you very much for your presentation and for everyone today.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
So are we done yet?
Rukavina, we're almost.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chair, I do have a question. I don't know if Ms. Grimes, who remember, might be the best one to answer it. Representative Vogel, probably the, and Benson, this program, like any other program that we fund grants or whatever to the Office of Higher Education, ends when you guys decide that you want it to end. So you're in the majority. You get to make those decisions now. So, and you got some tough decisions to make. But Ms. Grimes, what I want to ask you is, you know, the bill that we'll be discussing today, and I think in the Senate cut bill, they've directed OMB to try to find, I think it was $200 million, and now is it down to 125, or Mr. Chair, Mike, maybe you can help me, 125, whatever it is. Would that directive go after money like, let's say, the state grant program or some of these other programs where there's a balance left on the bottom line? I mean, I don't know where you find that kind of money now at this point of the fiscal year, but has OMB, as an example, gotten to you and said, look at what you have left in the state grant program and you may have to give some of that back to the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, my understanding is that how that might apply to agencies has changed somewhat as the bill has been going through the legislative process. In House Ways and Means, there was a comment about $32 million being available at the Office of Higher Education for grants. What that is money that's about to be paid out for grants for spring term, and mostly, and to some extent summer semester. And many campuses started their semesters in January. There will be others that have a J term in January and start their semesters in February or March, and there are some that have trimesters and start their semester a term in April. What happens when we do a state grant is that when a new term starts, the campus has to verify that the student is enrolled and how many credits they're taking, and then send that information in to us, and then we do a payment roster of sending the money back out to the campus. So these few weeks right now, quite a bit of that money, as each day passes, will be then sent out to the campuses to be attributed to students' accounts. The students have already received a financial aid letter in which they were told how much money they would have to help them pay for their education this semester, or this year. So that if some of those grants were stopped right now, for example, that would essentially mean the student would have to scramble to come up with money that they had not planned for in terms of what they would use to pay for their year of education.
So, Mr. Chair, Ms. Grimes, the way the bill is written, is it cloudy, or would you assume at OHE then, or Mr. Michiganis, that money is encumbered and therefore been spent? So there is no money.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Rukavina, technically the money has not been encumbered. It's not the process that we have used in the past, simply because it's technically difficult to do it is to draw down an encumbrance. This is easier to administer. My understanding, again, I haven't seen any engrossed versions of the bill in either the Senate or the House, but my understanding is that the Senate bill yesterday did exclude the state grant from consideration. That was one of the reasons they dropped the number from $200 million down to the $125 million, I think. They also excluded, I believe, some money that was set aside for veterans, the GI Bill.
And so,
Representative
Mr.
Camino.
Chair, would things like child care grants or the work study grants that may not have been given out yet, would those still be on the table then?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, actually those two grants are zeroed out. No, we've already sent that money out.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, before we break up, can you give us an idea, do you have any idea at all with the Senate on when we're going to have our joint House Senate Higher Education Committee to listen to the regents?
I do not have an update for you. We're hoping to hear something soon and get together and
you gotta start
we'll let
pushing.
You know.
You're the big wheel here, Mr. Chair.
Well, I know, but we work as a team.
The Senate never works as a team with the House, Mr. Chair.
Any suggestions? When would you like to do it?
I'm just curious.
No, I understand.
We were wondering in the 8th Congressional District because we wanted to represent Murphy as the dean, the senior member of the 8th Congressional District, wanted to call all of us legislators from that district together, senators and reps, and she just wanted to know a timeline, and I told her I would try to get that from you.
Yeah. I'd say we're about a month away, probably.
Still that far away.
Yeah. A lot of the candidates for Board of Regents are still making their rounds. At least they're coming to my office. And so I think that
nobody comes to my office anymore.
I will see if I can do something about that. But so as soon as we hear and
send it my way.
I'll do that. Representative Atkins?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This and just very genuine question. There's no politics at all involved in this question. The other day I asked you kind of what was going to happen with respect to the bill. You responded that it's not really your bill, and I understand how that's going about. But the points that Representative Rukavina brought up, that the Senate GOP recognized relative to vets and to the state aid or state grant program, is there something coming this afternoon? That's not going to be part of the, you know, taking away money that we've obligated to these kids. They've already got the award letters, for heaven's sakes. We're not really going to take that money away, are we?
That's not my intent to do that, no.
Is there going to be an amendment, I hope?
I can't verify that either. There will be amendments. I'm pretty sure about that. But
well, my question, Mr. Chair, is if it's your amendment, it's much more likely to pass than if it... No offense, Mr. Rukavina, Representative Rukavina. But, you know, we are what we are. We're in the minority. If it's something that you're going to... I'd love to be on that amendment with you. So my question is, will you propose that amendment for us?
At the same time, these two bills will have to get together, assuming that ours changed without any changes. Theirs has changed. They'll get together. We'll have to, we'll have to go to a conference committee and work that out. So if it doesn't happen today, it will happen probably at a later time if we go through conference.
Well, let me ask it a different way, Mr. Chair. If I propose the amendment, would you sign on it with me to keep those kids whole that are getting their state that already got their state grant letters and keep those veterans whole? Otherwise, I'm looking at a whole bunch of folks that are in some pretty tough districts over there. They're going to vote to cut veterans and they're going to vote to cut state grants. Not to mention guys like us that I think most of us might be voting no anyway. But for heaven's sakes, we've given our word to these young people that they're going to get a state grant.
It's my opinion that I don't think it's more of a general net that we're throwing out there to see where the money is. I'm not sure that we're specifying where we're going to get it from.
But we could specify, Mr. Chair, couldn't we, that it won't come out of the state grant program?
Well, that's a debate we'll have to have. I'm not ready right now.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
If I could chime in here. So if you're not willing to do it, Representative Banyan, would you be willing to do that amendment then? Because I know you were concerned last week about some of the discrepancies in the bill.
Members, I think we can probably work this out beyond this committee. I don't think we don't need to just members on the spot at this time.
I can see where Representative Atkins is coming from. Good guy that he is. He's nervous that some of your freshmen are going to take a very bad vote today and not when they intend, and he doesn't want them to lose next election. So. Well,
I'm sure they appreciate that concern. But if I had and I'm the chair, so I think I'm going to do this. We're going to adjourn early, and then you can have any discussions you'd like between now and 3 o'clock. That'd be all right?
I'd be good.
We are adjourned.